Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 374. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about motorbikes and the American War and lots of soup as we go to Vietnam. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have two news stories for you. In the first one, it's not an unusual story to hear that somebody got kicked off a plane because they wouldn't listen to a flight attendant and stay in their seat and turn off their cell phone. In this case, it was a group of students that were kicked off an AirTran flight. One of the things that makes this story unusual, it was the 100 students and chaperones kicked off a flight that only held 134. The plane was indeed sent nearly empty. And the second news story, a plane was diverted this week, an Air Canada flight, because someone on board was screaming for help and asking to be let off the plane. Unfortunately, it was the pilot. As one eyewitness said, the cockpit door opens and there is the pilot, and he starts screaming and holding on to the airline attendant saying, "Help me, help me." I'm seeing the pilot saying, "Help me." I'm a little concerned. He was screaming, "Get me off the plane." You don't want to hear that. For links to both those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Jody Ettenberg. It's my pleasure to have Jody back. Jody comes from Legal Nomads, has been on the show before talking about Chile, and has come to talk to us about Vietnam. Jody, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me again.
And the other thing that you have done since you were last on the show is you become an author and wrote the Food Traveler's Handbook. So we'll be talking a little more about food both in this episode and then at the end, I suspect.
Yes, I usually will be talking about food. It's a problem I have.
You make it sound like you are 300 pounds, and yet I know that that is not the case.
Yeah, it's funny. In Vietnam, one of the guest house owners had looked at my blog before I had stayed there, and he was shocked. He genuinely came up to me and said, "I really thought you'd be fatter. I don't understand how you eat so much and you're not fat." And I was like, "I eat when I'm hungry. I stop when I'm full."
Excellent. So Vietnam, why did you go to Vietnam? And why particularly do I know that you are planning on going back?
Well, for starters, I had spent, I guess, close to almost 3 years in Southeast Asia in general in the last 5 years of travel and writing that I'd been doing. And I'd never made it to Vietnam. Every time I wanted to get there, something else came up. And by came up, I mean I fell in love with a different place. And so I stayed there longer. And so this time I was visiting my brother in England, and Emirates had a sale to Vietnam. And I had recently tried a whole bunch of different soups that are known in the south of Vietnam. One of them is called Can Chua, and it's a pineapple and tomato and tamarind sort of sweet and sour soup with this herb in it that I had never tried before. And my brother said, "Why Vietnam?" And I said, I want to find this herb and see what else it's cooked in. And he said, "Okay, well, then you should go." And I went.
So it's the soup that led you to Vietnam.
The soup, yes. It is the soup that led me to Vietnam, and it is the soup that kept me in Vietnam far longer than I expected. I extended my trip and changed my ticket twice, actually. I was supposed to leave on March 3rd, and I ended up leaving in mid to late April because my father kept saying, "Why are you staying?" And I was like, "There's more soup. I need to eat more soup."
So, and you were down in the southern part of Vietnam.
Right. I had rented an apartment. Basically, instead of traveling around, I rented a place in Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon in District 1 on the border of District 3, basically. And I had that as a base. I definitely took trips around the country, but primarily I wanted to dig around in Saigon itself, and all the beautiful manifestations of different cuisines from the country are found in the city too. So you do get to try a lot of what the rest of the country has to offer from immigrants from elsewhere in Vietnam.
Excellent. So as our tour guide here to, especially to Ho Chi Minh City, formerly Saigon, and to that region of Vietnam, let's start with, what would you recommend if we came over? What would you take us to see? What should we see in that part of there? And then we'll talk about what we should eat also.
Sure, sure. I think big cities are generally quite difficult to see in a traditional sense. It often feels less fulfilling than seeing a smaller place because the sites are more disparate and it's chaotic. And part of what I love about big cities is truly staying put and sort of getting to feel the vibe of the city. But if you have a few days in town, there are certain things that I would take people to see. The palace and some of the architecture that exists is very jumbled compared up to Hanoi. There's buildings that are modern. There's some that are older. They're all kind of butting up against each other. So I often suggest that people pick a district per day to wander, starting in District 1, seeing Notre Dame Cathedral, some of the old buildings that have been turned into embassies that are now sort of the colonial style buildings that exist, walking down to the riverfront and seeing what exists down there, because there's a vibrant culture at night where people take their motorbikes and they sit by the river at night and have snacks and watch the boats go by. But then in subsequent days to really go out, once you've done that, once you've gone to the War Remnants Museum, to go out and pick a district a day. Each of the districts, much like, for example, areas of New York City, have very different feels to them. So pick a day and go to Cholon, which is the Chinese district, basically around a big market in that region and the old post office. If you go and wander, you'll feel a very different city than if you were back in District 1. So in terms of rewarding yourself with exploring the city in chunks, that's the way I would suggest people do it.
Okay, and let's back up just a little bit here. You mentioned the districts, and the districts are obviously numbered. I don't know how many districts there are.
Well, the primary ones in the region of downtown, I would say downtown, it's a huge sprawling city, but there are up to 10 that most people tend to visit when they're there. And District 1 is sort of ground zero for tourism in that it's where most of the hotels are. It's where the old Hotel de Ville is and the Art Deco post office, which is still used today. Some of the old buildings that exist, a lot of them are in District 1.
So District 1 has a lot of French colonial architecture then, it sounds like.
It has quite a bit, yeah. There are aspects of it in other districts. It's definitely the most preserved in that sense because it's where most of the tourists do go. And it's easy to walk around in. There's a few markets in the vicinity as well that are great to wander. And the districts were renamed and renumbered and changed around when reunification happened after the war. Well, the Vietnam War, which is referred to as the American War in Vietnam. So that what originally were the districts have been rezoned and changed around. What is now District 2 was not used at all and has become a very expat area for people who stay in the city long term. But for people who are visiting, District 1, District 3, District 5, those three are the main ones that I would suggest people wander around. And you can get a great sprawling map when you arrive and it shows you just how big the city is. But those are the three, and they're quite large, each of them, that are, I think, most intensely rewarding if you have a short period in town.
Okay. And then you briefly mentioned the War Remembrance Museum. So that is the museum about the American War, or for us, the Vietnam War.
Right. It's changed itself over the years as well. I think the government has changed some of the exhibits and moved it around. But essentially, it has some of the old planes and artillery information and actual planes in the courtyard of the building, and as well a lot of photography and a different side to what we may or may not have learned growing up in North America about what happened. Definitely important because obviously it's a huge part of the country's history in most recent history, but as a lot of Americans were concerned about being American or telling people they were American when they visited Vietnam. But we found primarily that most Vietnamese people we spoke to had no resentment. There were very few that had any issues with people being American at all. It was more one series in a series of kind of colonial steps from the country dating back to many, many more years before that. And in fact, there was very little resentment at all.
Well, in fact, a lot of the population doesn't even remember it. A lot of the population is younger.
That. Sure, but those museums do exist. And of course, kids do learn in school about period of their history. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for people to see. And I think a lot of Americans I met who did go to the museum were very surprised, not having had access or been exposed to the other side of the story. Not that either side is the right side, but that it's always important to listen to both sides when you learn about anything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the other thing that you said that I caught was you mentioned it being a chaotic city. And I remember reading I remember reading some when Sherry Ott, a mutual friend, was there and she was writing her motorcycle diaries about learning to ride there. When you say chaotic, are we talking Rome chaos? Are we talking Istanbul chaos? What's the level of chaos we're talking about here?
I think there's two things. There's optics and then there's reality. So mm-hmm. I think from an optics perspective, it's far more chaotic than Rome or Istanbul or even Marrakesh, to be honest. Mm-hmm. There's just this persistent sea of motorcycles, like insects crawling around fast-paced around the city. When you stop and when you look, people joke about crossing the street there. You just have to go in the middle of hundreds and hundreds of motorbikes. You just have to start walking into the street. And the key to crossing the street is just to go and have a consistent pace and keep moving slowly across, and the bikes will go around you like water over stones. It's amazing, but it works every single time. And you just have to go, which is hard to tell people who grew up in a situation where your parents said, don't cross the street until you look both ways and there's nothing coming. Well, you're never crossing the street if you do that in Ho Chi Minh City. But there's something a lot more orderly about it when you start really looking at what's going on. People are moving more slowly than, say, in Bangkok, for example. The bikes are moving more slowly, more metered. Everyone tends to just look around them at all times for other things that are moving their way because they have to based on the way the streets move. And when I say everyone, I mean the people driving motorbikes. So I saw very few accidents in my 5 months there. There were a few, but less than my time in Thailand for sure. And I think when you get down to it and you stand and you watch it, there's this uniformity in the chaos that's actually kind of comforting. So from the outward perspective, it looks insane. And crossing the street the first few times, when I crossed the street with a friend of mine who lived nearby, we would high-five each other every single time we got to the other side of the street to the curiosity of every Vietnamese person. It was like, come on, guys, that was just a street crossing. We're like, high-five, we made it, we're alive. I mean, it just, you feel that sort of validation by doing it. I'm vindicated, I can cross the street. But after a while, it becomes easy because you just do see that people watch, they go around you, you move slowly, they move slowly. There's a beautiful stop motion video that had been done a few years ago that I have on my introductory post. Right. And it's fabulous because it just shows there's this kind of refined music almost to the way that everything moves in the city, which outwardly seems crazy. And then when you get there, you're like, this is actually beautiful.
Now, when I hear your descriptions, I think of my wife, who's a city girl. So we live as much in the country as she can possibly picture living. And we live in suburbia in San Jose, urban suburban sprawl. And we live probably as much in the city as I ever want to live. This sounds like a place for people who thrive on the pace and the beat of the city culture.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I grew up in Montreal, which is not a huge city, but I lived in New York for almost 6 years. And I love cities. For me, Bangkok versus Chiang Mai, I would take Bangkok because I love the energy and the fast-pacedness of it. For people who are not city people, they do find Ho Chi Minh City chaotic. And Hanoi is, with the lake culture and the sort of downtown area, the old city, it's much more comforting for people who don't want that kind of chaos. There's also great ways to get out of Ho Chi Minh City when you're visiting. It's not an easy place to get in and out of. The airport is quite close and it's easy to get to the airport.
On public transportation, I assume?
On taking a taxi. Okay. Costs from District 1 anywhere from $5 to $8. It's quite close to the city center. But in terms of buses, there are buses that take you out of the city. The traffic is horrendous getting in and out of Ho Chi Minh City. Going down to the Mekong, which I highly recommend doing if you have time, not on one of those one or two day tours that take you to four cities, but to really take a bus out down to, for example, Kanto, which is C-A-N space T-H-O. And from there, seeing the floating markets that are becoming less and less prevalent. There's almost as many tourist boats as market boats right now. But going down there and exploring is wonderful, but it takes forever to get out by bus. So to the extent people are in Saigon and they're finding it overwhelming that there's flights that you can take to the smaller airports in the country that can alleviate that kind of chaos for you.
Okay. And then you say the Mekong. We're talking about the Mekong River and the Mekong Delta, which is where Saigon is just north of there, I want to say?
Yeah, it's about a 4.5 hour bus ride to Kanto and a harrowing 4.5 hours. I actually texted a friend saying, I've never done this before, but I'm not sure that we're going to make it through this bus ride. So I'm just texting you to let me know exactly where I am in case you don't hear from me in 1 hour. That was how I've been on many buses. It was a harrowing bus ride.
Now, you're not talking about mountain traffic or driving in Peru or something. So what made this harrowing?
Well, in this case, the bus driver was drag racing a truck. On a 2-lane, one-way each way highway. Mm-hmm. So it was basically drag racing onto incoming traffic. So that was what got, not just me. I mean, the whole bus was kind of craning their heads forward, trying to figure out what was going on. I will say that, and this is not the company I was with for this bus ride, but the most generally recommended bus is this bright orange bus, and it's run by a company called Futa Travels, F-U-T-A. And they have offices off of the backpacking district in Famnulao. So generally they have the best safety record of the buses in southern Vietnam. And that was the one that everyone had recommended, which I did not listen to because it took longer and I paid the price.
That would be a tourist bus. You'd be on there mostly with tourists.
No, it's mostly locals, actually.
Okay.
Most of the buses were full of locals and not tourists. It seemed that because people tend to spend more time in Hanoi and up in Halong Bay, the people that came in and out of the southern cities either flew directly upwards to Hoi An or to Nha Trang. And then if they took a trip to the Mekong, they usually took the sort of 3-day trip that they booked with a hostel instead of the local buses.
Okay. So we've got you on the show, and you obviously have a passion for the food in Vietnam. So we might as well talk about that now, because we know we're going to talk about it at some point. Did it live up to your expectations, first of all? Yes, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely did. And I think we have such a small exposure to what Vietnamese food is. Mm-hmm. At least I do. Coming from Montreal, there are definitely some great Vietnamese restaurants, but nowhere near the breadth of what I discovered in Vietnam. And it was every single part of the country has a different food and a different way of eating. But more importantly, what we all know as like pho soup, for example, is extremely different from north to south. And that was something I didn't realize either, that even dishes that we grew up saying, oh, this is traditionally a Vietnamese dish, have extremely different tastes depending on what part of the country you were in. So it was really fun and really rewarding to eat my way through these different parts of the countries and discover the local herbs and spices that were used that I had no idea were part of the cuisine because I just wasn't exposed to it before.
Okay. And not everybody understood the name of the word that you used for the soup because they've seen it written on the signs if they have a Vietnamese restaurant, but there's a great debate on how to say it. And I think you said it correctly, but this is the one that in English is spelled P-H-O, but it's not
right.
It's not pronounced pho, it's pronounced pho.
Right, almost like fur with the R slurred. Yes, that's how it's pronounced.
Okay. I just wanted people to be able to know what you were talking about and that it might be, they may even have seen places that have this. And so when you talk about for instance, I think of, and San Jose, where I live, actually has the second biggest Vietnamese community outside of Vietnam. So we have quite a few pho places. So I think of a big bowl of a broth with noodles in it and beef, and then I put in a red chili pepper sauce. So that's what I'm used to. What right. is going to surprise me when I go to Ho Chi Minh City?
There's two things. There's some recent articles as well that came out that talked about how pho was only a breakfast food. And again, that's a big difference between North and South. Huh. There were places right near my house in Saigon that had they only opened at 5 p.m. and they were open until 2 in the morning and all they served was pho, nothing else. So the idea that it's a breakfast soup is, it is something that's eaten for breakfast for sure, but not in the South as much as in the North. A lot of people do eat it for dinner in the South. The northern style pho's, they subsist on the basis of their broth. So most of us, and I'm not speaking of your region because you have, I think, more of a breadth of food than I did at least, but most of the people who left Vietnam that came, let's say, to Montreal were from the south. And sure. So we got southern style pho, which was a sweeter broth, a lot of herbs to dump over the soup when you dress it. And then, yes, that chili sauce, often a plum sauce that goes with it, and just a very different taste to the ones I tried in Hanoi, where the broth stood for itself and had flavors of cardamom and cinnamon and some cloves in it too. It was much, much more rich and much more clear as a broth in terms of color. And there were almost no herbs. No place I tried had herbs in a big pile to put in the soup. They had chopped up, pre-chopped, like green onions and some other herbs outside, but none of like the big bowls that you get, that we get, at least in Montreal, when you order that kind of soup. So southern style is sweeter, has some cuttlefish sometimes added to the broth, and in the north, it's much more salty and clear with tones of cardamom and cloves that you just don't taste near Saigon. There are Hanoi-style pho joints in Saigon as well for the people who miss it. But for the most part, regular, just they call it pho Saigon, and it tastes different than the north. So all this was new to me. I just thought of it as like, oh, it's a soup that people eat in Vietnam. But of course, that's very myopic of me. And I found out in learning and eating that it was not the case.
Just talking about food for the moment, what else surprised you about the food in Saigon, in Ho Chi Minh City?
Yeah, so most people in Saigon call it Saigon. Most of the people, it's funny, when I wrote about it originally, I'd have friends who were like, it's not Saigon anymore. And I'd say, well, I mean, I know technically it's not, but everyone there calls it that. District right. 1 is still referred to as Saigon. So I just use both because I'm like, I've given up not offending people at this point. but essentially, it wasn't so much surprising as it was just so fulfilling. Every single day there was a new vendor that I found randomly trolling the streets. I had a friend who also loved food, and we'd run around on a motorbike, and because he was driving, I would be on the back and I'd be like, stop, I see crab soup. And we'd stop the bike and jump off, and it would be in the middle of District 10. There's nobody there but locals, and they'd all be looking at us like, what are we doing here for crab soup? The city is just full of fabulous food, and wandering around the streets, busy places, but different times of day, different foods appear. So at 4 p.m. when I want crab soup, I can always find crab soup. At 10 p.m., I can also crab soup somewhere else. The beauty of the city was that there was just this constantly roving set of vendors and foods. And at any point in the day, I could find a myriad of different tastes and smells that were just fabulous. I mean, I loved my time there because there was no shortage of stuff to discover.
And then expanding that question outside of food, what else surprised you about the city?
This is very personal, but people kept asking why I was so small. Like people kept, I didn't expect.
Now because, to be fair, you get that a fair amount.
Well, I mean, I'm not that, I'm 5 feet tall. It's not like I'm 4'2". Mm-hmm. It's certainly not small for Asia, but I think that was the point. In Thailand or elsewhere, people joked that I was a Thai-sized white person, but random people would stop me on the street and just ask why I was small and if my mother fed me as a kid. And it was hilarious. I mean, I was just so surprised. I was like, yeah, no, she fed me. They're like, but she fed you not enough. And I was like, no, I mean, I think she fed me plenty. It was just so funny that, and friends of mine that walked around with me would be so surprised because people would just come up to me all the time. And I asked my other female friends in the city, is this happening to you? And they're like, no, I think it's because you're small and you're Vietnamese sized, but you're not Vietnamese. And they think it's hilarious. So that was a surprise because every day there was some ridiculous story of like someone coming up and handing me a balloon and just being like, hi, here's a balloon for you. It's so, so funny. But I will say that it was a great source of connection, and it was funny to have these encounters. And part of what made the time beautiful too for me was that Vietnamese people loved that I loved food, and they took great joy in the fact that I was trying to learn, and these ladies would walk up. I would order something on the side of the street and someone would come up and be like, no, you're folding that piece of pancake wrong, and take the lettuce out of my hand and refold it and dip it in the thing, in the sauce, and give it back to me with this look that's like, see, that's how it's supposed to be done. And there was kind of that interactive aspect of it that really came through using food as that tool to connect, which is what I always advocate. So of all the countries I've been to, I think Vietnam really was one of the more rewarding in that sense, because people care about food so much that they're just thrilled that you care about it too.
Excellent.
I will say in general, though, that people ask questions about eating the fresh herbs on the street and eating the fresh vegetables because of safety perspective. Yeah. Is it safe? So I never once got any sort of food poisoning from eating there on the street. And I only ate on the street. In fact, a friend, this like reverse obnoxiousness, invited me to try. He was like, I found this new Kanchua place. You should come and try. And I showed up and I was like, it has tablecloths. I don't know if I can eat here. Like, where are the plastic stools? He's like, come on, Jody. So primarily I ate on those plastic stools and sitting on the side of the streets. And people say, you know, your stomach was used to it. I came from England before that, and I was in North America for most of the summer and fall. So yes, it may be years of being eating street food, but generally speaking, very, very few people I met got sick from eating on the street. If you're concerned, there are restaurants that use distilled water to wash their vegetables and their fruit out for you. There's a great Ban Say Ao place, which is this giant turmeric rice flour pancake thing that you fold up in lettuce. And I can give you the name of that place for your show notes.
Please.
If you'd like. And there's another one where for people who are concerned about the street food, this gentleman essentially took all the street food options from throughout the country and sort of congregated them in this one restaurant where you can get them all. And it's traditionally everything is done with distilled water. So it's twice the price of regular street food, but it's an option for people who are obviously afraid of getting sick. But again, I did not once get sick from the street food there.
What I'm guessing, twice the price of regular street food is still not expensive.
Correct.
What is a typical meal cost on the street and then in a restaurant that's twice as much?
Well, it depends on, I mean, the exchange rates are often what matters. So compared to US dollars, most food would be between $1 and $1.50.
Okay. That's what I was picturing.
Yeah, about that. So you'll be paying $3 to $5, sometimes a little more in the bigger cities.
Okay. You were there for 5 months. I don't know which 5 months of the year you were there.
I was there from December through April, and Christmas time is actually a very interesting time to be there as well.
Well, you're leading into my next question. Which times would you recommend and which times would I potentially want to avoid?
Right. The hot season kind of sets in around March or so, February, March, and April is on the cusp of the rain, but there were one or two days with some rain when I was there, but that's about it.
Now I'm picturing that's the hot season versus the not quite so hot season.
I mean, when I first got there in December, I was wearing sweaters and fleeces at night, but I'm also always freezing. Most people found it very pleasant, like 20 degrees Celsius in the evening or so.
So about 70 in Fahrenheit.
You guys are trying to be different still. I forgot.
I some of us speak both. But
I think one thing that people tend to say get out of town for Saigon is Tet, which is the Lunar New Year, basically, in February. And I stayed put this year for it. And I wrote a really long post about it, advocating that people stay. But it really is a fascinating time. If you have quite a bit of weeks in the city or in Vietnam entirely, and you can get a chance to contrast that week against the rest of how the city feels, it was fabulous, because there were all these days leading up to the actual New Year where people were running around doing all these errands. You buy kumquat trees, so you have them in your house for fortune. You buy all these red envelopes, and everyone seemed to also provide shortbread cookies, these Danisa. I don't know how they got a monopoly, but these Danish shortbread cookies, everyone got that as a gift for someone else. So they had just storefronts covered in boxes of cookies. Just really interesting things that the city changed fundamentally as the New Year lit up. And then there were obviously a lot less stores and restaurants open, but there still were restaurants open, plenty to eat. And it was fascinating. I think if people have enough time, it's a great time to be there. If you're only going for a few days, then January is a great month to be in the south. It's quite cold in Hanoi at that time. So I would say that if you have time in Vietnam during the January month, it's nice to be in the south. Mekong, and also in Saigon.
And when you say quite cold, not quite cold compared to Montreal?
No, not much is quite cold compared to Montreal. But I went up to visit friends in the north, and I was wearing everything. I mean, I had fleece and rain jacket and hat and gloves. And it's this kind of damp cold that really gets into your bones.
So San Francisco weather is what you're saying, really?
Yeah, precisely. Yes, that is what I mean.
Okay. When we talked about food, you mentioned cookies, and that obviously is a more Western thing. You didn't mention, and I know why, but I also understand that, for instance, one of the things that some people are surprised about is some of the best baguettes they've ever had were actually in this area because of the French influence. Now, that's not a food you eat, but...
So I have celiac disease, for those listening that don't understand what Chris meant, but essentially, I was diagnosed about... I guess 13 years ago with celiac, which is now trendy. Being gluten-free is more trendy, which is great for me, have more options. So the banh mi, the breads are these light and fluffy baguettes, and they were originally brought in by the French. The current recipes usually use half rice flour and half wheat flour. Hmm. So they're a lot lighter than the traditional breads you would get. And banh mi sandwiches are a very popular breakfast food in the South. And there was a lady on my little alleyway that rocked up around 6 a.m. and set up her shop and stopped around 8. And she had grilled pork on rice, or she had banh mi sandwiches for breakfast with egg and pate and a whole bunch of stuff. So that is one of the influences from France. And there are some fabulous vendors around town that offer, I have had friends do banh mi crawls to see where the best ones are. I did try one anyhow to see. I was like, how bad could it be? It's half rice, right? It was terrible. I was sick for several days, but it was good. It was delicious. I think another funny influence too, for people who speak French and come to Saigon, they have something called nui, N-U-I, which is a bastardization of the French word for nui, N-O-U-I-L-L-E-S, which is macaroni noodles, essentially.
Okay.
And they also call a fried egg, instead of the traditional name for it, they say it as opla, O-P space L-A, which is a bastardization of œuf plat, which means flat egg in French. So there are some funny little quirks with the food, but a primary influence, yes, is the banh mi sandwiches. And from what everyone has said, they are fabulous.
Excellent. Best day you spent in Ho Chi Minh City?
It sounds ridiculous, but I did wake up every day just being really thankful that I could build a life where I'm getting paid to eat these wonderful things every day, and just excited to see what I could discover in terms of food. I think one of my favorite days was where a friend and I went to Cholon, to District 5 and District 10, and we wandered around the markets. It was just such another world in there, and there was just no other tourists at all. And it was just eating what the markets had on offer. I love puer tea from China. They had this woman who sold fermented cakes of puer tea in the middle of nowhere.
And that one, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's a tea cake, like the flattened disc almost of tea from Yunnan province in China. And it's like a very earthy, it tastes like dirt, but I do love it. I don't know. I think it's fabulous.
And you sell
dirt
it so well.
Dirt is delicious. I know. It's very good. I hadn't found it in Vietnam before. So it was just this sort of huge vats of traditional medicine, these sort of dried herbs that are used in Chinese traditional medicine, doctors lining the streets. And every one of these kind of small streets that were spoking outward from the bigger market had something else to sell. Every street kind of had a theme of its own, and people were waving, and they were just so surprised that we were wandering around. But it was just this day of real discovery in a way that you just don't often get in a big city. It was fabulous.
One person you would really love for people going over there to meet?
Everyone I met, I think in terms of a type of people in Vietnam, I would encourage everyone to look at, observe, and appreciate the Seom drivers, the motorcycle taxi drivers in Ho Chi Minh City, because they are hilarious. They put their bikes up on their stands and they lean back, kind of taking over the world, just leaning back and watching everything. And they watch everything. They know everything that goes on. They're often the best, fastest way to get from A to B, but they have usually these huge creased smiles and faces that have seen everything. They've wandered around the city for so long, and they know all the shortcuts, and they're usually some of the most jovial people. I think some of the more memorable interactions I had with locals was taking a Seom somewhere and him taking a shortcut somewhere, or taking a detour, finding a new food place because I was on the back of the bike and he agreed to stop and we had a meal. It's just really, they're really fun, interesting characters. And it was fun to negotiate with them too. They'd give a price and I would give half of that. And then they would, we would just sit and have this negotiation process. Usually they would throw their helmet at me as a, okay, I agree to your price move. And then by the end of it, they would just be laughing that I was laughing at this whole situation going on. And it ended up every single time being a whole new story. They're really a fabulous group of people to see, and they're everywhere. People at every street corner, they'll ask you, do you need a motorcycle taxi? So I would say take the time to stop, and if they speak any English, ask them about their lives, because they're often very fascinating people.
And you say motorcycle taxi, and I don't have a clear mental image here. Are we talking about getting on the back of the bike, a sidecar, or mm-hmm. more like a motorized rickshaw?
Man, I wish it was a sidecar. That'd be awesome. No, you'd get killed. There's no way you could have a sidecar in Vietnam. They're on the back, and they all have two helmets, so you get one and they get one. They always give you a helmet when you get on, and you just on the back of their bikes, basically. You usually can spot them because they're lying on the back of their bikes, their feet on the handlebars, just like watching the world. And they often have two helmets hanging off their motorbikes. Great personalities.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned laughter. So one thing that makes you laugh and say only in Ho Chi Minh City?
Oh, it's just, I think the crossing of the street is fabulous. There's just no other city where you step into a sea of traffic and are encouraged not to make eye contact, because in many other cities, people say, you know, Marrakesh, people say, make eye contact, the driver will then stop. Here they say, just look straight ahead and walk slowly and everyone will go around you. And it's such a strange process to try and get used to. But, and watching people try and do it for the first few days when they're in town, I remembered myself just not actually having an idea of how to, I just go? And everyone's like, yeah, just go. But it is fabulous to watch because it is such a huge part of getting around in town. And I think a fun way for tourists and travelers to kind of feel extremely happy with just even something small like getting across the street. It feels like an accomplishment every time.
Excellent. We've mentioned your home and we've mentioned Ho Chi Minh City. So one time when you felt closest to home and one time when you felt furthest from home.
The closest to home, there are little things that remind you. I don't know about you, but smells for me remind me of home more than not. Yeah. The smell of pine trees, for example, in the Philippines really reminded me of being at home and living near the forest with my family, because it was a pine tree forest. In this case, it's something very, very small and not related to Canada per se, but my father's worn the same cologne his entire life. And I went to an event and the guy was wearing the exact same cologne. And I just kind of stood there stunned for a second. And he was like, are you okay? I said, yeah, no, I'm fine. It's hard to, you don't explain this to a stranger.
Yeah.
You smell like my dad. Yeah, that'd be awkward. But that was probably a pang of homesickness or people sickness, I guess. I missed my family at that point because it reminded me of them. And in terms of being far away, those during Tet, the new year, my landlady, so you can rent a room in Saigon. Basically, a lot of places will offer service departments, which are studio apartments. They have a fridge, a desk, a bed, sometimes a balcony. And it's in a house where the family lives in the bottom, and they have six rooms or so above where they rent them out to locals, foreigners, whoever. So in my case, my landlady just happened to speak fabulous English. She lived in Australia on exchange once for a year. And she loved that I love food. So the rest of the family spoke no English, but would nonetheless knock on my door and bring me downstairs to poke my face in whatever they were cooking, which was fabulous. And on the New Year holiday, it was also the 1 month anniversary of a baby that had been born in the house, not her daughter, but her husband's brother's kid. So in traditional Vietnamese family, a lot of the families do live together. In this case, it was the grandparents, their oldest son, which was my landlady's husband, and his brother and their family as well. So they were like, the landlady said, we're going to kill a pig today, and then we're going to roast it, and we're going to have a big feast and you should participate. So it was very otherworldly to basically be in this feast of people in the middle of downtown, roasting a pig that we had just killed in the middle of downtown and partaking in these big festivities where it culminated in them asking me to get up and sing the national anthem of Canada for everyone. So it was a big room of people, which I did in English and in French, the way I learned it. And then they got up and all sung their national anthem. And I was just standing there kind of half stunned. It's, of course, the kind of interactions we all really crave when we travel and want to connect with people. So I was just so grateful to be invited into their house and the celebrations for this new year and their son. And yeah, it was an overwhelmingly wonderful evening, and I'd wanted to be nowhere else but there that day.
Excellent. Before we get to our last two questions, the traditional two questions, what else would you like people to know before they go to Ho Chi Minh City?
I think there's a few little things. The reputation it has for cab drivers, for example, ripping you off or the like, you may actually find that people would take the time to take a longer route than necessarily needed. It's definitely possible.
So you're saying it might be a $10 cab ride instead of a $5 cab ride?
Yeah, exactly. I would say less than that, generally speaking. But the cabs have cleaned up their act for the most part. There are two companies. Vinasun is one of them and Mylin is another. And those are, they come out of the airport. You can take them around town. They all go by meter. I never once had to say, please put up your meter. Mm-hmm. And someone said, no, it was always just fine. So it's Vinasun and Mylin. They're two that are totally reputable. And just basically, the ice is generally made from filtered water, but I often carried handy wipes to wipe down chopsticks at street stalls since my street food is generally very fresh and very popular with locals. So it's not like there's no culture of street food. It exists. And food poisoning from rotten food is often very rare, but there's certainly some potential issues with the sanitation of the cutlery. So I just usually wipe down my chopsticks if they look a bit awkward. And the last thing I would say is, to pay attention to your phones. There's quite a lot of phone theft, and that's not specifically Vietnam, it's everywhere, but I've seen many people on their phones, and some guy on a motorbike comes by and kind of swipes it in mid-conversation. So I use a little attachment thingy from a company called Kinu that's called a Highline. It like attaches into my phone, and then it loops around my belt buckle, or it loops around a zipper in my bag. So trying to tether your phone to something or just use it closer to the walls of the building than outside near the street would be my other tip, because there is quite an issue with phone theft.
Excellent. And then, of course, carry your safety whistle.
Yeah, never forget your safety. I didn't use that once in Ho Chi Minh City.
Jody has an article about safety whistles on her blog, and I will put a link to that. So last two questions. Finish this sentence. You really know you're in Ho Chi Minh City when what?
When you can cross the street with your eyes closed and make it safely to the other side.
And if you had to summarize the city in three words, what three words would you use?
Chaotic, energetic, delicious.
Excellent. Where can people read more about your travels, Jody?
Mostly on my own site, which is Legal Nomads. So that's legalnomads.com. And the same for my Facebook page and Twitter. I use the same name. Basically, didn't start out writing about food, as you know, but as the years have gone on, it's become a personal obsession and therefore one I write about more as well. My aim being not to make it a snobby thing, but to just encourage people to use food as a way of learning the most about a new place.
And your new book again is?
My book is called The Food Traveler's Handbook, and that's essentially the thesis of the book as well. It provides both practical ways and some of the stories like the ones we've talked about, but obviously different since it was published prior to Vietnam, about food as a connective tool and then how to demystify eating safely so that you can go about and stuff your face around the world just like I do. I'm actually also, I'll be starting up food tours this year as well, which I have not yet launched, but that is my plan to do wherever I happen to be, smaller 6-person food tours. So the first place I'll be doing that, it'll be Bangkok, and then it'll be back in Vietnam when I return.
Excellent. And when we talk about the Food Traveler's Handbook, my understanding is that not only did you enjoy street food and find good street food and have recommendations, but also talked different vendors into teaching you how to make street food, how to make the foods that they were providing.
Yes, that was for the first few years when I traveled, and it was much more of movement than renting a place like I do now. It was a great way to learn about a specific dish. And the way I would do that was I would find a street vendor that I liked who was friendly enough and basically say, look, I'm going to bring people from my hostel to come eat here for the next 4 nights. And I would like to sit with you during those days and learn about how you cook what you cook and where you get the food and what you do. And almost always they were confused, but very happy to show me how they made their food. And it was sort of, I had never read that or anything anywhere. It just seemed like, well, if I offer something of value, maybe they'll take the time to teach me. And And often they were women who ran the shop and had no problem showing me and seemed to appreciate as well, like I said about Vietnam, that someone else would also be so enthused about their food that they'd just want to sit there and learn about it. So it was an extremely rewarding way to eat new things and try them. And I didn't really write about it on my site. It was more just for me. I really enjoyed it personally in every city I went to that had a vendor that was willing to do so.
Excellent. Well, Jody, thanks so much for coming back on the Amateur Traveler.
Thank you for having me. It's been a while. It's been fun.
I'm traveling this week, so I don't have as much time to put the show together. So with that, we will end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral.